Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, the weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter Hai, and I'm pleased to welcome Kai-Fu Lee to the broadcast. Kai-Fu is a prominent venture capitalist, technology executive, artificial intelligence expert, and the author of the new book, AI Superpowers, China, Silicon Valley, and the New World Order. Currently, Kai-Fu is the founding CEO of Sinovation Ventures, a Chinese venture capital firm with $2 billion under management, a third of which is invested in artificial intelligence. He founded Sinovation Ventures after leading Google's initial entry into the China market as the president of Google China. And prior to Google, he spent a number of years at Microsoft as a corporate vice president. While there, he established Microsoft Research Asia, which is widely considered one of the best computer science research labs in the world. Kai-Fu began his career as an AI researcher, having obtained a Bachelor of Science degree in computer science from Columbia University and a PhD in computer science from Carnegie Mellon University. In this interview, Kai-Fu discusses his new book, in which he highlights the stunning government-supported progress China's technology sector has made in recent years. He goes on to argue that China is well-positioned to surpass the U.S. in AI prowess and the reasons for that country's gains. We also discuss the risk of job displacement, why U.S. companies struggle to break into the Chinese market, and why the reverse is also true, what Sinovation Ventures looks for when identifying new opportunities, and a variety of other topics. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. The Forum on World Class IT is brought to you by Transmit Security. Transmit Security designs and develops platforms that address problems in security and usability by making it easy for developers to implement advanced authentication techniques ranging from biometrics to behavioral profiling. As the risk of cyber attacks and hacks increase, companies need a more effective way of preventing unauthorized access. I recently caught up with the Transmit Security CEO, Mickey Budai. This week, Mickey discusses how to derive additional value from working with startups, such as leveraging the domain expertise and passion of the high-quality talent they attract in unconventional ways.
Number four is about startups. Startups are a great source for innovation. Very little innovation is coming from the big vendors today, while startups, on the other end, are all about innovation. Startups have another great advantage, which is that they attract high-quality talent. The founders and the team around the founders are typically domain experts with a lot of passion for what they're doing. They're also very eager to succeed, very eager to show value, and are not going to give up easily. On the other end, there are risks working with startups. They're less mature, less organized, might change direction, might have financial challenges down the road. My recommendation is try and drive additional value from startups in their field of expertise. So for example, if you're working with cybersecurity startups, the founders and the core team are most likely domain experts. They can provide opinion on your security architecture, on some of the directions you're taking. They can help identify complex security issues in your environment, help investigate incidents, etc. Most of them would be very happy to do this, as long as it's close enough to their technology. It's an opportunity for them to demonstrate expertise, service, and commitment. And in times when good talents are very hard to get, thinking out of the box and using the talents that are knocking on your door could be very rewarding. This way, it's almost guaranteed that every interaction with a startup returns value, even if you ended up not buying their solution.
Tune in next week when Mickey will discuss factors for choosing vendors. Lee, it's a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for taking time with me today.
Thank you.
So, Kai-Fu, I thought we would begin with, in many ways, you personify, or at times at least have personified, what I believe at least and others have mentioned as one of the key secret ingredients of the U.S.'s entrepreneurial spirit. You were an immigrant to this country. You're a native of Taiwan. You
went to school here, undergraduate, graduate school. You stayed here, worked for a number of technology icons like Apple and Silicon Graphics, Microsoft, Google. You took a risk, so to say, by going to a different country and succeeded in that country. And actually, there was a time when, by comparison, people talked about that lack of immigration, that lack of that entrepreneurial spirit that immigrants have, as a disadvantage that China had relative to the U.S. That seems to have changed, especially in recent years. Of course, as somebody who has spent considerable time in both countries, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what has led to this dramatic growth of the entrepreneurial class in China.
Certainly. I think it's a number of factors. One is just that a very rapidly growing market and the business opportunities that present itself. I think a second is that the government has, through its programs, one called the Mass Entrepreneurism and Innovation Plan, is really trying to reverse the traditional, maybe conservative mentality. Another one is just the role models. I think the best role model was probably Jack Ma, who was more like the boy next door, not the super genius who has a PhD from MIT, but the boy next door who went to an ordinary school that couldn't get a job at Kentucky Fried Chicken, and he built the largest e-commerce empire in China. And that was an inspiration, and I think that those combinations of things drove up the entrepreneurial spirit in China. It really changed in the last 20 years.
Yeah, indeed. And I want to mention, congratulations on your terrific new book, AI Superpowers, China, Silicon Valley, and the New World. I wanted to ask you, a little bit and cover a few themes that you cover in the book itself. You've talked a bit about as a number of tech giants have grown within the two countries, they've largely operated in parallel. And actually, if you think about you think about the great technology brands in each of the companies, there have actually been, or countries rather, there have been relatively few who've succeeded in the other markets. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of the differences that in some ways act as barriers for technology leaders in each of those countries as they attempt to enter the other.
Sure. I think in the beginning, it was just a cultural language difference. And I think it was the Americans who had by far the better technology in 15 years ago. But the American companies didn't view China as a significant enough market to devote special energy. So simple U.S. products were localized to Chinese language and expected them to be good enough. And sales teams were sent to China with a revenue target and the quota. But it was too early to monetize, and China grew too fast as a market and then I think the American tech giants 15 to 10 years ago more or less missed the chance to extend their technical empire to China. But once the Americans missed it, the Chinese companies came and filled in, and they actually came up with a very different set of products that were more suitable for the Chinese people. Things that were more interesting, video-based social networks, technologies that taught English and shared bicycles, and using use of mobile payment to eclipse the entire period of credit cards. So a lot of innovative uses emerged. So now when you look at an average Chinese person's phone, you'll see a totally different set of applications, apps and usage patterns, and it's now too late because it's like there are two puzzles. One is the American puzzle with Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, Google, YouTube, etc., Amazon, etc., and then there's the Chinese one with Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent, but also with the new players like ByteDance and Didi and VIPKid and Mobike. So now you've got two puzzles, and the pieces are cut differently. So now you can't just take an American piece and make it fit on a Chinese puzzle because it doesn't play with the other parts. So I think we've now reached a point where China and US are really two parallel universes or two puzzles cut differently. And now it's really incredibly hard for any tech company from either country to succeed in the other.
You've talked also about how some of the unique advantages that China has. One of them is a data advantage. You've also talked about the need to have a mentality of a gladiator in China, which is very different from the mentality of the business environment in the U.S. Can you describe each of those, both the data advantage that China has, as well as this gladiator mentality that you refer to?
Sure. The products are now made better with more data, and that's primarily because of artificial intelligence. AI, whether it is predicting what you're going to buy, sending an ad that you might click on, or recognizing your face and speech, those technologies all work better with more data. And China simply has more users and more data per user, leading China to become the Saudi Arabia of data. So a Chinese company and the equivalent American company funded similarly with similar products, the Chinese company would end up with a better product because the product would have AI trained on more data. So that is a big advantage in China. The other advantage or difference is that the Chinese entrepreneurial style is a winner-take-all, work extremely hard, amazing work ethic, and building very high walls, building products in a way that others cannot copy. So it's almost an opposite business model to the American entrepreneur, which prefer lightweight technologies like Instagram had 11 engineers when it was bought for $1 billion. But the Chinese team would hire 10,000, 20,000 people to build incredible capabilities and operational excellence to ensure that a competitor would not be able to replicate the technology. And they fight very hard. You know, in the U.S., let's say in the food space, there is Grubhub, Yelp, Groupon, Open Table. But in China, there's just one Meituan. Because had there been four such companies, they would have fought to the death with only one remaining. So I think the competitiveness, the tenacity, the work ethic, and the desire to build uncopyable business models are really Chinese specialties that would give China an advantage. It also means China would move more quickly. And if there were more data, it would even give a quality advantage. So at this point, in terms of implementation and monetization and creating value, I think China is now ahead of the U.S. In that aspect.
You had an interesting experience of working with one of the tech icons in the U.S., Google, and establishing and running their Chinese operation. You grew that to $1 billion, so rather significant, and actually grew its market share in its business significantly. You were there 4 years, and actually a few months after you left, the company left the mainland, that Google did. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your own experience, about your reflection on that experience and what you learned from that.
Sure. I think Google is an amazing company, and I learned a tremendous deal about building great products, about applying artificial intelligence, about having really smart people and a fantastic culture with technical excellence. However, I think Google was destined to have a hard time in China. When I went, it was fortunately still early enough that we had a shot. There were not yet the two puzzles or parallel universes. We were able to squeeze in our little piece in the puzzle, and we were able to increase market share from 9% to 24%. This was between 2005 and 2009. Had Google stayed and maintained the 24% share, then today it would have a piece of the puzzle that would make it very difficult to remove and maybe even opportunity to grow. However, once Google pulled out, China pretty much quickly filled up that piece of the puzzle and created its own intertwined but solidified parallel universe. Now, for Google or any other American company to come back would be quite difficult because that space has been filled and Google as a brand has largely been forgotten.
You mentioned in your book that the term superpower has three meanings. We talked about two of them, the U.S. versus China, the U.S. tech icons, the Amazons, Googles, Facebooks, Apples of the world, the Chinese icons, the Baidus, Tencents, Alibabas of the world, and the competition, the parallel universes, the different puzzles, as you've referred to. You've also briefly referenced the third of the superpowers, which is artificial intelligence itself, and its ability both to create enormous opportunity, but also its probability to cause a tremendous amount of job displacement. You were, through your venture fund, Sinovation Ventures, relatively early, especially in China, in investing in artificial intelligence. If I've got my data correct, of the roughly $2 billion you have under management, a third of it is in AI, five unicorns you've invested in a variety of different places, from autonomous vehicles to semiconductors, deep learning generally, finance, some others as well. I wonder if you could talk about your own perspectives, you're peeling back the onion a bit further than you already have in terms of artificial intelligence and the opportunity you see there.
Sure. I think artificial intelligence, and by this I largely mean machine learning through deep learning, reinforcement learning, and those types of technologies that were invented about 10 years ago and really grown and perfected over the past 10 years and now at maturity. And I'm talking about applying them to a wide variety of industrial applications. These technologies are not quite the science fiction AI. These are little AI. We call them artificial narrow intelligence, in the sense that if you have one narrow domain with a tremendous amount of data, you can make a system that beats people, whether it's in face recognition, speech recognition, targeted ads, or e-commerce optimization, trying to maximize revenue or minimize default rate for a banking loan. So it's almost can be applied to any domain, but only one single domain at a time when you have a huge amount of data. So this technology, on the one hand, doesn't give us science fiction, doesn't give us robot overlords, but it does give us a great tool for building phenomenal amount of wealth, extracting value, replacing work that we humans weren't built to do or not as good at doing. So the natural outcome is this kind of AI would be applied to internet, banking, insurance, healthcare, retail, manufacturing, education, pretty much every fabric of our lives. Wherever there is a routine job that is being done, AI would go in, do it better, do it tirelessly, and do it at very small marginal cost. So the net impact of that is that all these businesses I mentioned would be able to make more money, have higher profits, lower costs, but also, as you said, there would be consequences, such as displacing human jobs, humans that have a single domain routine jobs. Now, of course, many of us have jobs that are complex, that are creative, that are not routine. But those people that have routine jobs, they, over the next 15 years, are going to be in potential danger of being displaced by AI. So in this book, while celebrating all the success and value that AI brings us, I also wanted to caution that the routine jobs will disappear. And that's going to affect a significant number of people. So that's another part of the book, is the superpower and the potential challenges that it brings to our society.
Can you talk a bit about your recommendations for governments, for example, on the programs they might put in place or other ways in which they might impact this displacement? The governments and other bodies, I suppose, as well. What are your recommendations?
Certainly. I think governments should do something, but also corporations and individuals. We all have to work together, because we're talking about as many as 40 or 50% of the jobs that would be displaced by AI and automation. And when the routine job is, person doing a routine job is displaced, it's not simply one person losing his or her job. It's about whether that person can find another job, because you can't simply take someone from an assembly line and turn them into a scientist. That is just not likely or practical. Another issue is that if the person goes from an assembly line into an auto mechanic, but that job is displaced too, and then goes into the job, another routine job, and that further gets displaced, then it's a continued process of depression the person would go into, and that's terrible. And finally, when someone loses a job, it's not just the loss of income, but the loss of meaning, because many of us associate our lives with the work that we do. This may not be the wisest thing in the long term, but it is. That is what it is today. So in order to resolve this issue, I think it is about several things. One is a redistribution of income. Somehow, the money that's made by the ultra-rich from the success of mobile internet and AI and automation and other technologies need some of that need to go into, whether it's through taxation or social responsibility, or setting up of personal foundations. Somehow that money needs to be funneled back to help the people who are displaced by these technologies. So that's the redistribution angle. Probably the easiest is through tax, but not tax of everyone, but tax of the ultra rich, tax of the people who benefit the most from creating the technology that displaced the people. Secondly, there needs to be a retraining. I think people need to be trained with new technologies, for new jobs that they could be had that would not be displaced. So what would be a domain that's large enough to accommodate that many jobs that would be displaced and yet isn't such a 10, 20, 30 year training that's going to be needed? I think the largest opportunity would be with the jobs that are compassionate and empathetic and have a high degree of human-to-human interaction, because AI isn't good at doing that. And even if AI became better over the years, at least for quite a while, humans will not accept having an AI being the service provider. So I'm talking about jobs that cross service and professional boundaries. So for example, nannies, nurses, elderly caretaker, but also teachers, doctors, psychiatrists, tour guides, concierge. So there's a wide variety of jobs, some of which are professional jobs, some are service jobs, but all of them have a human communication connection component in terms of building trust and connecting with another person, that you don't want to see a doctor who's a robot. You don't want a caretaker or a companion who is a robot. So I think those jobs are large enough in number, and the amount of training in general, maybe with some exceptions like doctors and psychiatrists, the other ones I mentioned might be trainable in anywhere between 1 month or 1 or 2 years. So it's conceivable that corporations can help employees basically reskill them, and countries and governments can also provide incentives and subsidies for people who are displaced to go through a period of retraining and then finding another job.
For a little bit more than 9 years now, you have run Synovation Ventures, and I wonder, how have you determined where to invest? What are some of the things you look for, both in terms of the entrepreneurs you invest in, but of course the ideas that they're pursuing?
Well, we primarily look for disruptions. So technologies that are disruptions or tend to grow in exponential pace, rather than taking an existing pie and then going to a zero-sum competition. We really like disruptions because disruptions create huge opportunities, very rapid growth. And even if we don't hit the number one bet, the rising tide lifts all boats. So that's the first thing. Second is that we really want to look for entrepreneurs who are very detail-oriented, very good at execution, who are exceptional leaders of people through thick and thin, that people will follow them. And we look for people who are detail oriented, know what they're doing, and not just talk the talk, but are able to walk the walk. And people who have the product passion and skills in the domain that they're in. Those are probably the two most important things. We obviously do look at the product they want to build, see if it makes sense. But we realize also in early stage startups, at even at Series A and B, sometimes companies will pivot. So we don't insist that the product they're building is perfect. As long as it's a reasonable product, going in a high growth space with very promising entrepreneurs, then those are the kinds of companies we want to invest in.
Kai-Fu is somebody who's spent considerable time on both sides of the Pacific, but especially in the US and in China, but elected to set up shop for your venture arm in China. To what degree is that a vote for China's long-term prospects as being somehow better than the US's?
I think both are phenomenal. I happen to have spent most of my professional career in China, and I think my company and myself, we have a better brand in China, so it's better to build off the brand and also use our experience in China to find companies. If I had the comparable U.S. experience and skills, I think U.S. would be an equally good choice.
Excellent. Well, Kai-Fu Lee, thank you so much for taking some time with me today, for walking us through some of the investments that you have made, your perspectives on China and the U.S. and some of the dominant technology players in each, as well as a variety of trends. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to the Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please rate us on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please join me next week when my guest will be Shafiq Khan, the founder of the Teach the World Foundation.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com.
And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.